This is the New World Report. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. Brazil's election is settled. Argentina has an election in the new calendar year. And we go to Bolivia, where there's surprising disruption. The headline, Bolivia in conflict with the country's richest province over shared resources. The official statement from Bolivia's Minister of Productive Development, Nestor Huanca. To safeguard food security, exports of soybean, sugar, soy oil, and beef are temporarily suspended. And this goes, he goes on to say, the measure has been in effect since midnight Thursday, October 27th, and will continue until normal supply conditions are restored for the entire Bolivian population. Professor, what I know about Bolivia, your guidance and reading, is that it is a country that is still troubled by its legacy, most recently, of Evo Morales. It is also a country that is rich in natural resources and foodstuffs, as this list indicates, and also extractive services. So this surprising safeguard food security, suspending exports, what is the contest? Who are the players in this contest?
John, this is part of a broader, longstanding fight in Bolivia, which has both political and economic dimensions. So traditionally, Bolivia, which is under its current constitution, a very centralized state, which means that you have the distribution and decisions about the distribution of resources from La Paz, from the center. But what they call the Media Luna states, the lowland states, including Santa Cruz, have traditionally been wealthier, especially coming from oil wealth, but also others. And they've traditionally been politically more conservative, as opposed to the highland states, the Altiplano, represented by La Paz and some of the indigenous people who have supported the left of center MAS government of Evo Morales and now Luis Arce. And so what has happened, and it's happened repeatedly, is a struggle for resources and political representation. So in this particular case, you have, again, that one of those conservative, prosperous states, Santa Cruz, led by a relatively conservative anti-MAS governor, Luis Fernando Camacho, as well as a powerful, what they call a civic movement there, the Santa Cruz Civic Committee with Romulo Calvo. Saying, hey, we're supposed to get this demographic census, which will determine the reallocation of voting rights and the reallocation of resources from the center. When that occurs, it will likely give more resources and more voting rights to Santa Cruz. And so the MAS government has continued to postpone and postpone and postpone having this thing. Well, maybe we'll do it in 2024. And so it came down this protracted fight to Santa Cruz saying, okay, no, we want it in 2023, stop delaying. And so that was the basis of the strikes. And then what the central government has basically done is to say, well, there's strikes and there's violence. And so we're going to essentially, shut down the border because of the violence. And so as a way of putting added pressure on those in Santa Cruz, because part of the economy of Santa Cruz, as well as part of the economy of Bolivia, relies on the flow of goods across the Santa Cruz, Brazil border, including soybean oil and sugar and beef and things like that. So they're generating the losses of something along the lines of millions of dollars, maybe as much as $45 million a day because of the strike. But at the end of the day, it's really about the census, and the census is really about the distribution of economic and political power between essentially the conservative, prosperous Media Luna states and the center in La Paz, dominated by Luis Arce and certainly Evo Morales, who also continues to be very influential in the MAS.
I see if I understand this. Santa Cruz de la Sierra is a very rich province, very rich. And it is now one part of the dispute between it and the government of Mr. Arce. But where is Morales in this? Because Morales was always more, he was transnational. He wasn't just about Bolivia, and he was also connected to narco-terrorism, narco-gangs, the Coco gangs. So is this outside, is this a separate contest from Morales and his bad acting?
It's indirectly related. Of course, Morales brought an unprecedented amount of stability to the complexity in Bolivia from his, from 2006 to 2009, when he was basically forcibly removed or forced to resign over his attempts to falsely engineer a fourth term in office, and was really caught by OAS observers. So when there were finally new elections that replaced the transitional government of the rightist caretaker Jeanine Añez, that Morales did not run. Morales was actually in exile at the time, worried about basically facing charges. And so essentially a person who had been a much weaker figure, a more centrist figure, a more kind of studious figure, Luis Arce, actually was elected president. Many people believe that this was the new MAS, the new more moderate MAS that they could let back into power and not the radical MAS of Evo Morales. At the end of the day, Arce basically continues to be heavily influenced by Morales. Morales is back in the country, and just because of his personal relationships and in his rhetoric, he has a lot of influence within the MAS and determining what happens. And so in many ways, Morales continues to be a very important and one could say radicalizing factor behind the scenes in the MAS government of Arce. And that certainly has some impact on how some of these disputes with Santa Cruz are fought. Indeed, in Morales's day as president, he was one of the keys in fighting the conservatives such as Camacho in Santa Cruz. And so this is really a continuation of a long struggle over those resources and political rights.
Also, some part of this is a border dispute or a border with Brazil. Does that mean Lula da Silva is going to get involved in this? Because he has a city, Corumba, is that how you say, Corumba, right across the border that is cut off from the normal flow of exports.
Brazil has always had some interest in the politics of Bolivia, just because Bolivia is one of numerous states with which Brazil shares a border. There have been issues with Bolivian gas, which is historically sent to Brazil, as well as the other ties. And so really that border is really the flatland of Santa Cruz Department as it gets into Brazil. And so the real issue here was the shutdown of the border by government decree, but also reflecting the strikes, which really impairs what is really a vital transnational, really ongoing interchange. Again, agricultural products and other products. In many ways, the economic life of some of those people in the eastern part of Santa Cruz is more tied to the western part of Brazil and its economy than to whatever decisions and economic things happen in La Paz. And so it's really the disruption of that border. And certainly Brazil has an interest in that border trade and in Bolivia. Although I do not see this becoming a Brazilian security issue in the near term, but rather just an unfortunate disruption as this plays out.
Professor, you visited Bolivia. All I ever see is photographs, and Santa Cruz looks like a sophisticated modern city. And in fact, Bolivia looks like a sophisticated culture and with much prosperity. Is it growing, and does it enjoy the fruits of its labor, or are there limitations after the pandemic or because of the misgovernance?
Well, John, historically, oil and gas have been one of the key industries in Santa Cruz, although you also have a booming agricultural sector because, again, it's relatively productive agricultural lands for cattle and as well as various different crops. And so, again, traditionally, because of the relatively pro-market in more conservative culture, and some would say a relatively different character of the politics and the people of Santa Cruz, it's had that prosperity. But again, it's a prosperity of that's driven by the oil sector. It's driven by the agricultural sector, which, going back to our comment about Brazil before, it's that same culture of self-reliance and independence of the cattle ranchers and others there that you see in the southeast of Brazil as well. And so I think we'll continue to see that. Certainly, it was hurt as many parts of Latin America by COVID-19. But again, with relatively high oil prices and with that traditionally strong and educated infrastructure, Santa Cruz and really the Media Luna states in general continue to be really part of some of the important economic drivers of Bolivia.
We will turn to Haiti in another full program because it deserves attention. But I want to mention that Haiti is an ongoing tragedy, and that the professor in introducing me to Haiti, I read about it all the time now. And if I were to characterize, these are distinguished articles by people who've studied the Caribbean for a long time, writing books on the matter, from foreign policy to foreign affairs, all the elite publications. What I find consistently, and it's not faulting the authors, is that there's a frustration and a confusion about what is to be done. It doesn't seem to be one version, intervention or more money or restoring the police department with armored personnel carriers. Many good ideas, but at the end of each article is, who knows, the feeling that we're adrift. Is that a fair characterization of what I'm reading, or your measure as well, Professor? Haiti.
It's a good characterization, John. Haiti, for me, is an example of the extreme case of this deadly and tragic reinforcing interaction between corruption and poor governance and violence and economic mismanagement. Things have gotten far more out of hand in Haiti than elsewhere, but it's to the point now where, in the utter absence of economic opportunities and a dependency culture and a government that really has ceded terrain to gangs, that gang violent situation has gotten completely out of control, something that was encouraged by the previous government of Moise. But the current government is facing the fact that you have at least 100 gangs, but the two biggest gang coalitions, what's called the G9 and Family and the GPEP coalition, and their affiliated gangs are really warring for control of oil terminals and flour mills and various other things, and really holding at ransom the ability to support and get aid to the desperate people in the greater Port-au-Prince area. And that's really what's driving this question of needing to put in a UN force just to stop the humanitarian disaster. But the risk is that, again, given past interventions, including the 1993-1997 UN mission, the 2004 to 2019 UN missions, et cetera, the failure of the NGO community really to bring benefit to Haiti. There's really, I think, a sense of cynicism and desperation. This is something that it's so bad that politically in the United States and elsewhere, nobody can turn away from this disaster. And yet, based on the past, I think there's a real sense that, difficult to really make a difference and bring positive things. And so it's the problem that no one can ignore, but everyone's afraid to get too involved in because of the sense that this will still not turn out well.
Professor Evan Ellis, U.S. Army War College, Strategic Studies Institute, Ecuador. There's good news, but there's trouble. This is the New World Report. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.